Support for today's broadcast is provided by Radio Maria, with an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu, and now taking reservations for their five-course New Year's Eve dinner. Serving starts at 5 p.m. Also, gift certificates are available. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to visit the Promenade Gift Shop and Krannert Center Ticket Office during this holiday season. For more information about Krannert Center performances in the new year, visit KrannertCenter.com. Support for today's broadcast comes in part from the City of Urbana and the Urbana Business Association, presenting The Market in the Square, Saturday mornings starting at 9 a.m. through December 18th, with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods, and original works of art, located inside Lincoln Square Mall in downtown Urbana. Information at 344-3872.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Russia. We thought recently that it really had been quite a long time since we'd had much discussion about Russia on the program, and thought that it would be a good idea to talk a little bit about what has been happening in Russian politics recently, maybe do a little bit of an assessment of Mr. Putin and what sort of job he's been doing, talking a little bit about Russia and its foreign policy vis-a-vis its neighbors, and certainly recently that has been getting some attention with regard to Ukraine. We'll try to talk a little bit about that, perhaps also talk about relations between Russia and the United States. And we have as our guest to try to explore some of this territory this morning, Diane Conker. She's professor of history here at University of Illinois. She's editor of the Slavic Review and has been interested in Russia for some time now. She's been good enough to come and spend some time with us this morning and also to answer questions. Now, as always, people who are listening are certainly welcome and invited to just call in, and I know that she would do her best to respond to whatever questions people might have. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call if you'd like to be involved in the conversation. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody is welcome to call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Dave.
There's a lot that we can talk about, and I guess I thought I might ask you to talk maybe in a general sort of way about Vladimir Putin and what has happened during the time that he's been running the country. On the one hand, he has said that he was interested in modernizing Russia. He has been credited for making some moves to try to reform the economy and so forth. At the same time, he's gotten a good deal of criticism for his method of operating, for his way of dealing with anybody who would criticize or challenge his decisions. And a lot of people have said that in some ways, rather than taking Russian forward, he's actually taken it backwards and moving towards the kind of authoritarianism that we saw back when the Soviet Union still existed. Having sort of said all that, can you say something general about him and how he operates?
Well, I think Vladimir Putin is still kind of a mystery, both to his own country people and to Western observers, because even the Russia experts are not quite sure how to predict where Putin is going next. He rose from obscurity. He was picked to be the successor of Boris Yeltsin. He came from the KGB. He was young and energetic, unlike Yeltsin, who was old and often incapacitated. Putin is a modernizer. He wants to take Russia into the 21st century, but he thinks the way to do that is to increase law and order, and to increase government control over what's a huge and unwieldy and a fractious country, which still covers 11 time zones and almost one-sixth of the globe. So he's very definitely been taking advantage of political opportunities to centralize power, to reduce the power of the regions, for example. He's just recently decided to appoint regional governors rather than have them elected. And he's enormously popular. There's a youth movement that seems to support Putin, and they run around Moscow with T-shirts with his picture on it. I read recently that he's still 95%, more liberal than 95% of the country. So he's a technocrat. He's a modernizer. And he's I think, going along in a Russian tradition to identify power with an individual personality. When I was in Russia in May, watched the state television channels, which is all that's left now. And it was very much like watching television in Soviet times. A lot of Putin doing his thing, talking to ministers, being official, and very little discussion of any other kinds of problems or any dissent or any deviation from Putin's line.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do we, from our perspective, we don't think that's the way to operate. But how does one assess what really that means, and what that has meant for Russia? And well, maybe another way of asking the question is Russia better off now than when Mr. Putin first became president?
Well, better off you have to measure on a number of scales, and it depends on who you ask. But you know, we value democracy and freedom, whatever that means. But we value that from a basis of 200 years of stability and a high standard of living. And when democracy, I'm putting that in quotation marks, when democracy came to Russia in the early 90s, it brought with it chaos and parties based on personality and people beating each other up in the Duma and members of parliament acting like children. And by the mid-90s, democracy was a dirty word, even for Russian liberals, even for academics that I came in contact with, because it had done nothing to stabilize the situation, and the so-called Democrats had done nothing to improve the economy. So there's not much of a constituency for the kind of democracy that we're used to. What Putin has done is sort of stabilize the economy. He's been, I think, helped by high oil prices. You know, the world economy, Russia's greatest resource is oil and gas, and with the current high prices, the economy is doing pretty well. And so this has helped to raise everybody's standard of living, made a larger but still small segment of the country very well off. And so they would say for sure we're better off now than we were 10 years ago. If you look at Moscow, Moscow looks much more prosperous now than it did 10 years ago. But you don't see that the pockets of poverty and the rural poverty that still exists. Mm-hmm.
We have a caller who's been patient here as when we go ahead and bring them in. In Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I may be asking you to simply restate what you've already said, but the question in my mind is, how does it happen that with the Russian vast resources and a small, relatively small population that could exploit it, they are not as well off in terms of a growing economy and growth in material well-being as the Chinese? Everyone seems to say that you look to the next 50 to 100 years to the Chinese as a dominant world power. And it may be that they have as much, perhaps fewer resources, material. They have a much larger population, and yet they seem to be accelerating, and the Russians not. Am I simply misunderstanding the last 10 years and they're poised for a takeoff? Is there something fundamental in the Russian soul that makes it hard for them to be a world economic power, but that even 50 years of communism hasn't stopped the Chinese tradition of entrepreneurialism? I don't want to be metaphysical about it, but why so much the Chinese now and not the Russians? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on the Chinese, so I can only talk to you about the Russian side. I think that the natural resources of Russia are quite different from China. They've always been able to exploit mineral resources, oil resources, and have relied on that kind of spurt for their economy. There's an economist now at Harvard, Andre Schleifer, who argues that Russia today is a normal country compared to Brazil, Argentina, Chile, with countries of that standard of living, gross domestic product, has similar levels of corruption, similar levels of growth. So it needs to be compared to the right family, and I think China is in a category by itself. I would suppose because of its population, largely, but also a different agricultural base and opportunity. So it's not that Russia should be compared to the United States or China, but with another tier of countries with which it ranks very well. I don't believe really in the Russian soul, but I do believe that there is a Russian soul that determines the way the Russians proceed. But there is a political culture, and it's a political culture that's based on centralization and a fear of risk-taking, which discourages the kind of entrepreneurial spirit that we see elsewhere, particularly in China, in South Asia, and other countries like that.
All right. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest for this hour, Focus, Diane Conker. She's professor of history at University of Illinois. But when some of the stories that we've heard now over the past few years about struggles between Mr. Putin and other people who move in the circles of power in Russia, seems that one of the things that we hear over and over again is that somebody who crosses Mr. Putin ends up in jail, and he deals very harshly with anybody who seems to challenge him or get in his way. And one wonders now, is what we're looking at really some kind of a struggle between some old style anti-democratic dictatorial kind of leader and people who were interested in moving towards a more democratic kind of country? Or is what we're seeing essentially is struggles between a number of individuals who essentially have the same kind of outlook? I mean, is this really a battle between the forces of democracy and the forces of anti-democracy? Or is this just a battle among oligarchs, people who are powerful and have become wealthy because of it and want to become even more wealthy and more powerful? And that's what really people are fighting about.
Well, it depends on your point of view. If your point of view is Putin's, then the struggle is between the lawfully elected government on the one hand and robber baron oligarchs on the other who made their fortunes illegally by using the influence they had within the government, taking advantage of the weakness of Russia at the time, and are now trying to use this ill-gotten gain to influence politics and also refuse to share by paying their fair taxes with the population. Khodorkovsky, who's the oligarch who's currently on trial and in jail, wants to present himself as a Democrat and defending entrepreneurial spirit and the freedom of Russia. He also had a very unsavory past in terms of his business practices before he reformed and decided to become a Democrat, buy newspapers, and then it was when he tried to challenge Putin politically that charges were filed against him. So nobody's really clean in this affair. The forces of democracy are elsewhere, and their voice is very silent, and they have very little public respect or public clout. These poor liberal parties that have been around since the Gorbachev time are barely getting 5% of the vote in the national elections. I did see in the paper this morning, though, that there's a new movement in Russia modeling itself after what's going on in Ukraine. It's not clear that these are really legal organizations, but one is called the Ukrainian youth movement is called Pora, It's Time. And there's an organization called Red Pora, or another one is called Orange Moscow. And this might be an alternative source of change and democratization with a real social base of the young, upwardly mobile, educated students and young professionals who are feeling frustrated by the increasingly authoritarian regime.
Another caller here. Next is Belgium. That's over by Danville, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I don't even want to butcher the poor gentleman's name. His face was so damaged with these dioxin recently.
Mr. Yushchenko.
Yes. Is there a relationship between what happened to him and Putin?
And just here we're talking about, for anybody who's not sure, here we're talking about Ukraine, which was one of the things that we wanted to talk about here on the show, because here we have a situation where we had two opposing candidates, one that was sort of backed by the government and was said to be favored by Russia, and then the opposition candidate, Mr. Yushchenko. He was the man who apparently was poisoned, seemingly an attempt to perhaps knock him out of the election or at least cause him a lot of trouble. What is Russia's? I guess the question is, you know, what is Russia's interest and involvement in all of this?
Good question. Russia, I think, again, to try to see things from Russia's point of view, they feel themselves increasingly surrounded by countries that used to be part of their sphere of influence who are now looking westward. And there's a competition between Russia and Europe for the loyalty of Georgia, for example, and Ukraine. And Putin, some people say quite stupidly, decided to openly support Yanukovych, the government candidate for president, who was also supported by those in Ukraine who wanted to tilt more toward Russia. Yushchenko appealed more to those in Ukraine who wanted to be more European, eventually join the European Union. European in all the senses of economic reform and rule of law and kind of a normal European society. What happened to Yushchenko personally, I mean, he's now saying that he was poisoned, in fact, by the head of the Ukrainian security police, who had very close working ties with the Russian successors to the KGB. And this is, it looks like a clear illustration of somebody trying to thwart the election. This has been part of the modus operandi of President Kuchma in Ukraine for some time. He's had journalists murdered who were opposing him as well.
I'm sorry. I should apologize to the caller. I jumped on your question. Did you want to follow up?
You did a much better job than I, sir. Take care.
All right. Let's go to someone else here. Line one is Urbana. Hello.
Good morning. You said earlier that Putin was a bit of a mystery man in his rise, but basically that with the way the Russian government has been, you know, becoming, to my mind, increasingly authoritarian, how about that he's not a mystery at all, once a KGB man, always a KGB man? And then this question for you. After our President George Bush met with Putin, he said he looked into the guy's soul. Well, I'm not sure the guy has a soul, but I would like your reaction when you first heard of President Bush's quote on that. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Well, I thought that was an interesting way to evaluate a world leader. It sounded to me like Bush hadn't done his homework and was going to rely on what the Russians talk about as soul and vibrations. I think I was also reminded of Margaret Thatcher's comment after meeting Mikhail Gorbachev, this is a man we can do business with. And perhaps that's really what Bush meant, but he wanted to express this in more mystical terms. As for Putin's KGB background, you have to realize that the KGB has been one of the best funded, most highly educated, and before the fall of communism, the most westernized of the Russian administrations, because they had to know the West in order to combat the West. So the KGB was a career path for really the best and the brightest. So it's not so surprising that Putin comes out of the KGB, and it doesn't necessarily predict that the KGB is any more authoritarian than somebody coming out of the Ministry of Defense or the Ministry of Justice or the Ministry of Internal Affairs, who are all have a strong interest in preserving order and keeping down chaos and anarchy as they see it in the country.
Yeah. Well, it was certainly we would have a certain kind of reaction to that. It would be kind of like, you know, someone who, like the former head of the CIA running for the president of the United States. You know, we might have a certain visceral kind of reaction to that. But as far as the Russians are concerned, it seemed like when Putin was running the first time, that there was a lot of appeal to for this image of strength. He was a tough guy. He was a strong man. As you said, he was certainly younger than Yeltsin, seemed to be more vital, have more on the ball. But it seemed that that he was making this appeal to people that he was the guy who was going to deal aggressively with the problem areas, aggressively with threats. Chechnya, you know, he was the guy who was going to go and who was going to take care of this problem. Now, whether he has or not, that's another thing. But that would point to the fact that maybe for a lot of Russians, his background would have been seen as a plus, and they wouldn't react to it maybe quite the same way that we would.
Well, I would remind you that George H.W. Bush was head of the CIA.
Yes, indeed, you're correct.
Before he became president of the United States.
You're correct,
aren't
you?
We didn't see that as a problem at all, or some people didn't. But as for Putin, again, understanding the context in which he came to power. First, we had this ridiculous Yeltsin presidency, who was ill or incapacitated much of the time. There was also terrorism coming out of Chechnya. There were apartment complexes that were blown up in Moscow, and some people say it was the KGB that did that in order to make an excuse for cracking down on terror. But they have not been able to solve the Chechnya situation, and terrorism is actually expanding in the North Caucasus rather than being eliminated. It's no longer reported on Russian television, Russian news, or there are accusations that when they do report what's going on in Chechnya, they're falsifying successful raids when they are unsuccessful. So there's a real visceral fear in the part of urban Russians anyway that this is a very unsafe place, and the Beslan massacre continued this. And we know ourselves from our own experience that when terrorists strike, it encourages more rigorous measures of law and order, more fear, more curbing of what we think of as freedoms and rights to travel or even to speak.
Another caller, Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I tuned in late, so I hope I'm not off track in asking this question. Going back 50-some-odd years, one of the books that I read, a history that I read as part of a course in college, was that of the attitude of mentioned the attitude of the or the development of the Russians with regard to liberty and that sort of thing, and the author stated essentially that prior to World War I, there were already the beginnings of the development of a democratic organizations and that sort of thing, particularly in the villages. And I haven't heard or read anywhere since then that this sort of a development was taking place. And if this is the case, is there a remnant of this anywhere at all in Russia now? And is it having any effect?
Well, there's been a democratic tradition in Russia. I mean, the village organization was a democratically run organization by the elders of the village, for example. Russia before the 1917 revolution was an autocracy, but it was an autocracy limited with an elected parliament after 1905. So there was that democratic tradition. When the Bolsheviks came to power, they came to power as a democratically elected political party in a kind of flawed election. And they also promised to democratize Soviet society so that workers elected their own factory committees and even managers, and there were elections to the Soviets. And throughout the history of the Soviet Union, there were elections with one party, of course, but elections nonetheless. So there is that democratic tradition. But it has not been terribly effective at solving some of the key problems of Russia. And so democracy seems to be a less important freedom than perhaps freedom from want. I think one of Roosevelt's four freedoms was freedom from want. And the economic situation has been so dire in Russia, both before the fall of communism and after, that the kind of democracy we think of with two-party system and campaigning and actual issues being developed, that has not developed as successfully in Russia as Democrats here might like.
Can I ask one more question or describe a situation that I'm personally aware of? One of my uncles came to this country from Russia in 1923, and I got into a short discussion with him about the situation in the 50s or the 60s with respect to Russia and communism and that sort of thing. Anyhow, he remembered that at the time that of the revolution, that is 1917, the first revolution, the Menshevik thing, things were very tight, and there was all sorts of secrecy and fear of the secret police and that sort of thing. When the Mensheviks came in for 6 months, everything opened up. There was no longer any more whispering and that sort of thing. And then the Bolsheviks took over, and the authorities clamped down, and from then on, things went from bad to worse. I just wanted to mention this because there was a period during the Menshevik period when things seemed to be improving as far as the Russian situation was concerned.
Well, actually, I've written a couple of books on that 1917 revolution, so I know this period pretty well. And you're right that there was a period of openness and liberalism, the coalition government, including the Mensheviks. At the same time, though, the economic situation was deteriorating disastrously, and crime was increasing exponentially. The army was falling apart, and soldiers were just moving back in the cities and robbing people along the way. So there was also a law and order problem at the time, which was one of the things that convinced a lot of people that the Bolsheviks' promise of order would be preferable to this kind of disorder that was taking place. And the Bolsheviks' promises about the economic situation to nationalize the land was seen to solve some of these economic problems. There's no question that the Bolsheviks did not care very much for democratic freedoms and had other items on their agenda. They did have a lot of support. This is not a cabal of power-hungry individuals. There were a lot of Russians, workers and peasants and soldiers, who actually chose that more authoritarian path, which they thought would better protect their standard of living and an improved situation in the future.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Diane Conger. She's professor of history here at University of Illinois. She's editor of the Slavic Review, and we're talking a bit about Russia. And again, if people are interested in joining the conversation, you can do that. We touched a little bit on Ukraine just a moment or so ago, and what's going on in Ukraine with the candidate of the government, essentially, the man who is the prime minister, Mr. Yanukovych, the struggle between him and Mr. Yushchenko, who is the opposition candidate. And as far as the opposition is concerned, one of their charges, I think, against the sort of establishment candidate is this was the candidate that was backed by Moscow and that the Russians should just stay out of Ukraine and not meddle. I think Yanukovych, for his part, has been critical of the opposition because he says, well, the opposition is being backed and assisted by the United States. And I wonder to what extent this might serve as an example of places where, well, maybe the interests of Russia and the United States are not aligned. And are there other examples that you can point to where that you can say, yes, on the one hand, you know, Mr. Bush and Mr. Putin are looking into each other's eyes and saying these are guys we can deal business with and do business with, and we have common agendas, fighting terrorism, one of those sorts of things. But in fact, there are real cases where America's interests and Russia's interests are in conflict.
Well, I think in many cases Russia's interests and our interests are in conflict, partly because we are both proud countries who are used to thinking of ourselves as superpowers, and neither country wants to play poodle to the other. So there is this tradition in Russia that Russia is a strong superpower, and one might say that they're feeling emasculated by the breaking apart of various former parts of the Soviet Union, and who are not remaining neutral but are somehow gravitating for one reason or another into the camp of the other. So that Ukraine, with this election, is if Yushchenko is elected, and it seems to be the majority of people want Yushchenko to be elected, clearly moving towards Europe. Georgia is another case in point, where the Georgian president was actually lived in the United States before he came back. They're making deals to have pipelines carry oil to U.S. firms through Georgia as opposed through the Russian part of the North Caucasus. In Georgia, Putin is trying to chip away at some of the border regions of Georgia. The Republic, the region of Abkhazia, is an area right now of civil war, and the Russians are encouraging the Abkhazians to take out Russian citizenship, having dual citizenship so that they at some point could have a referendum and decide really they want to join with the Russian Federation on the other side. This is all part of this jockeying for power. There's also United States troops in the Central Asian republics, as was in Uzbekistan, a very authoritarian republic in its own right, which is part of our Afghanistan effort. So from the point of view of Moscow, Moscow is being, you know, surrounded by a power that's been traditionally hostile to the Soviet Union and to Russia, that is out to enhance its own economic well-being at the expense of Russia's, competing for markets, competing for loyal customers. So just geopolitically as well as historically, there is reason for conflict between these two countries. But there's also reason to cooperate, and Putin has continued to be cooperative on eliminating the threat, taking control over the nuclear material, nuclear weapons. So he's still a grown-up in the world in this respect, unlike some other world leaders one might think of.
Yeah. One of the things that I understand that they're in Moscow that they're very concerned about is holding Russia together, continuing to hold it together, and that they watched the old Soviet Union come apart, and that they're sort of determined that the same thing not happen with Russia. And the fact that still we're talking about, you know, the Soviet Union was enormous. Well, Russia's still pretty big, and it covers an enormous amount of territory, and that there are a lot of different peoples who may indeed have some ideas about autonomy, if not independence, and that that's one of the reasons why Russia has been so aggressive in Chechnya, because they're wanting to, you know, because when the Chechens declared independence, the Russians said, this is just not going to happen, because they wanted to make sure that not only were they talking to the Chechens, but they were talking to anybody else who might have the same kind of idea. And they were, it's indeed setting an example of saying, this is what's going to happen. So if you're thinking about this, don't. Just to what extent, and we've talked about how there is a lot of unrest and trouble in the Caucasus, to what extent are there potential, is there potential for that other places in Russia, other places where individuals might say, you know, we're really thinking about going our own way, and that would be a concern to the government in Moscow?
I think the further fragmentation of the Russian Federation is an issue. I mean, the Soviet Union was a multi-ethnic state from the beginning. Ukraine is a multi-ethnic state. Belarus is a multi-ethnic state. This is a part of the world where there are a lot of different peoples, and they're all mixed up. And the promise of the Soviet Union was that the economic development that would be possible by uniting all these people would raise everybody's standard of living, and it would be possible to preserve one's local culture and yet partake of this modern, technocratic, educated state. And I think that's still the policy of the Russian Federation, that all these ethnic groups, they try to appeal to them, you would be better off, these autonomous republics inside the Russian Federation, rather than being an independent country on your own. Chechnya is an extreme case of this, has had issues, we might say, with the Russian Empire going back
for a long time.
Hundreds of years, that the Chechen people were deported en masse by Stalin for being supporters of the Nazis during World War II, so they have particular grievances with the Russian government as well. One way that the government tried to sort of co-opt these ethnic separatists was to move a lot of Russians into these areas. So part of the conflict in Chechnya is a lot of Russian residents who are living in Grozny, who are victims of this as well. So on the one hand, they're being fierce with Chechnya as an example, while at the same time they're trying to do positive things with other larger groups, more willing to go along. They're also taking advantage of the worldwide war on terror to do what they like in Chechnya as well. And Putin, going back to the earlier question, you know, one of the reasons for Putin was so popular was he promised to, in very vulgar terms, to crack down on Chechen terrorism. It's just not clear to me in the 21st century whether military force alone is possible, sufficient to crack down on terrorisms in Chechnya or elsewhere.
Well, that I guess that again invites some question about maybe the relationship between Russia and the United States, and the extent to which the United States would like to suggest to Mr. Putin that he either do something or not do something. And this seems to be a particular case where he said to the United States, and sort of using the war on terror as leverage, he said, look, you got your terrorists, I have mine. I'm not going to tell you what to do with yours. Don't you tell me what to do with mine. So any attempt the United States to suggest maybe his Chechnya policy was not the right, he just said, go mind your own business. How does one characterize the relationship now between the United States and Russia?
Well, I think at one level, I think in the State Department and in other agencies, there's a working relationship with Russia. And there's certainly lots of ties and connections in terms of the business community as well. I think head-to-head, the relationship is much more fragile because Putin, especially with this recent intervention in Ukraine, is clearly trying to project his power in a way that he hadn't before. And there is a sense that the United States would like to see Russia as being irrelevant on the world stage, that the invasion of Iraq could be carried out without any worry of a reaction from Russia. And that's offended the Russians as well, who want to be players on the world stage. So this is a tension that's going to continue. I mean, when this happened under Gorbachev used Europe as a kind of foil against the United States, made openings to Germany, for example, and France. I don't see Putin doing that right now, which is curious because there is such a division between the United States and its old European allies these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is this may indeed be more of a question about America and American foreign policy, but obviously, when the Cold War ended, the place of Russia, its significance in American foreign policy certainly changed. And it's not what it was as we started to pay much more attention to the Middle East and to East Asia and to China and to North Korea and so forth. And that's not to say that Russia doesn't matter, but it seems like it doesn't matter as much as it did. So in what way now, as far as the United States is concerned, how much does Russia matter?
How much does Russia matter? That's a good question. I think the calculations in Washington have been that Russia doesn't matter. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State, because her professional background is as a specialist on the Soviet Union and on the Soviet military. And so she has a certain hardline take on Russia. But I think she, too, would like to minimize the importance of Russia, and one could imagine that U.S. policy would be undertaken to strengthen the Ukraines and the Georgias and the Moldovas at the expense of Russia. Expansion of NATO is part of this, and probably could do this with impunity because there is no real flashpoint for Russia to claim it's what it thinks is its rightful place on the world stage. Complicated areas might take place with Korea and China. Russia also borders on Korea and even has a significant Korean minority. So there actually is a role for Russia to play in working with the North Koreans on a transition there or on curbing nuclear arms there. But I think it's possible to draw a big circle around Russia and say Russia doesn't matter, it's not a safe place to invest, we just don't have to worry about Russia anymore.
We have about 15 minutes left. We're headed in the last bit of the program here. Let me again introduce our guest, Diane Conker. She's professor of history at University of Illinois, editor of the Slavic Review. If you have questions, call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just a moment ago, you talked about the NATO expansion, and that's again one of the big things that has happened since the end of the Cold War, as some countries that were part of the Warsaw Pact became part of NATO. And even now, more recently, we have some states that were actually part of the Soviet Union, like the Baltics, have have come into NATO. Clearly, it seems that when there was the discussion of about this first round of expansion, that the Russians sort of said, well, we're not happy about this. But it was clear that they really couldn't do anything about it. Just how is this the fact that these states that either had been within the Russian sphere, you know, those things they call the near abroad, or actually had been part of the Soviet Union, now becoming part of NATO and becoming more allied, sort of making this move to become more allied in many different sorts of ways, both in terms of politics and security concerns and economics, which I think is what a lot of these countries are really interested in, establishing ties with Europe. I mean, does that really – how much does that upset the Russians?
I think initially it upset them a lot. The expansion of NATO was clearly something of great concern. They seem to be more accepting of this now, but I think that the struggle is going to be over markets. Russia itself is a big market for Eastern European manufacturers who maybe can't crack the European market. So there's still a lot of economic ties and an opportunity for economic cooperation. So that's on the positive side for stability. And hopefully that will continue to ameliorate the situation, because I think Russia has recognized that it can't really change NATO. The expansion of NATO and the outcome might be to sort of renegotiate what NATO stands for so that it's not perceived to be such a threat.
We have some other callers. Let's talk with someone listening this morning in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I've been listening with interest. Your guest has alluded to all the things pre- and post-Cold War and the events in the world since then and the triumphalism of Western hegemony. It appears to me that there is nothing that has been said either this morning or internationally or around the world that the disease of capitalist imperialism and how that works. Everything falls under that agenda. Everything is dictated by that. And who shall be supreme? Who shall be the largest of hegemons? Is it going to be the conflict, as always, you know, the 19th and 20th century all full of wars that kills millions and millions of people and destructive to almost obscenity over markets and money and domination and those things that, in my opinion, have driven the world just to insanity, the things that we have now witnessed. And lastly, the fact that that the triumphalism over the fall of communism, which there was no communism in Russia ever, I mean, that revolution was short-circuited and made to be secondary, even at its height. What does humanity propose to do about the imperialistic nature of our economic system? I'll take my answer off there, and thank you very much.
Well, I don't know what sort of response you can offer.
Well, I think one of the positive roles that the old Soviet Union played was to provide an alternative economic model to the capitalist model. And I think also that encouraged the rapacious, so-called rapacious capitalists to clean up their act. And with the absence of an alternative, I think it does allow capitalists to be a little more unbridled and unchecked. And this might be part of what the struggle in Russia over Yukos is all about. Is the government trying to renationalize this oil company to provide an alternative and to curb what they see as the unchecked power of capitalism?
All right. Well, let's go to Bourbonus, I believe, next caller. That caller changes his mind. We'll go to Bloomington, Indiana, line 2. Hello.
Let me ask about Russia's economic prospects, especially you just mentioned Yukos. And it looks as if Russians are simply trying to nationalize a successful business. And here we have, to the east of Russia, China, which is growing, allowing business enterprise to flourish. And they're growing very fast. America is growing. Our economy is growing. Europe is not growing. But there sits Russia. I mean, is Russia just going to be left behind with China growing rapidly to the east of them, and we're growing to the west of them? What are they doing? They're seizing their businesses. How can they grow?
Well, this is a good and timely question, and Yukos is undergoing bankruptcy and is also on the auction block. I think what's going on in the Kremlin is that there is an attempt to take back control over the leading sectors of the economy so that they don't fall not only into private hands but into foreign hands. And so it looks like Yukos is going to be bought up, or the large part of Yukos is going to be bought up at bargain basement rates by what's already the state-owned gas company, Gazprom. And the phrase for this is that the government will control the commanding heights of the economy, will allow entrepreneurial spirit to proceed at other economic levels, and between the two of them there will be incentives for growth, but also mechanisms for controlling unbridled growth and particularly unchecked foreign investment into Russia.
If you were a Russian businessman, having seen the government just seize Yukos, you wouldn't be too eager to put a great deal of effort into growing a business.
No, and the stock market in Russia is falling as a result of this, and I think the government has to take this in mind. The government cannot get back into the business of central planning the economy. That did not work. But there is a sense that the government has to have some stewardship over the economy. And the next months and years are going to be another period of struggle over how best to raise the standard of living and raise the economic level of Russia.
Well, thank you.
All right. Now I think we're going to go to Bourbonus, line four, I think. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
The previous caller talked about the disease of imperialism, but it appears that the more dread and immediate disease is the disease of AIDS. And what I understand, the country is on the verge of being decimated by it.
The AIDS situation in Russia is tremendously serious. It's part of a much larger public health crisis altogether. Since the 1980s, the life expectancy of Russian men and women, but particularly men, has been falling. AIDS is rapidly spreading. And the low level of economic development there's been very little investment in medicine, in hospitals, and in preventive public health. This is one area where non-governmental organizations are actively working inside of Russia to try to publicize awareness about AIDS and to try to work from the bottom to stop this stop the spread of this epidemic. But it's a huge demographic and social problem. There's no doubt about that.
And apparently the government itself is trying its best to shovel it under the rug.
This is true to some extent. The reaction in Russia is once again not to admit problems if one can help it. So certainly on the state television, there's less concern about AIDS than there is in the press and that there is on the internet. But I think one thing that's really changed from the Cold War days is the internet. And even if Putin cracks down on state television, it's possible for those with access to get a lot of different sources of information, and that is really kind of one of the checks and balances of this new system.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, that gets at another dimension that perhaps we haven't talked about, and we have talked about a little bit about economic issues and some politics and foreign policy, but this gets into the idea of things that would come under the heading of other very significant challenges that Russia faces in the future, generally health, specifically AIDS. Are there other things like that?
Well, there's the standard of living in Russia is still extremely low, and what's happening right now is a huge disparity between those who are very rich and well-off and sort of live on European standards of living and those who are very poor and who really have no prospects. There's a law in the parliament now to raise the minimum wage to $20 a month, whereas those with a European standard of living make $1,000 a month or $2,000 a month. So there's this huge disparity. These people are living in the same society. Life chances for those at the lower end of the spectrum are decreasing. They're the ones with the health problems. And this was one of the problems that provoked the 1917 revolution with the great disparities between rich and poor. Mm. And this is something that the government has to keep in mind again.
Well, we're almost at the point we have to finish. I guess and this is perhaps a difficult question, but I mean, for people who, unlike you, who are completely absorbed in Russia, its history and its politics, if we're watching what happens here over the next couple of years, what's an important thing to watch for, or how do we try to understand what it is going on there and try to understand it more from a Russian perspective rather than from an American perspective?
I think the thing to watch for is what happens with Putin and the elections and the Russian constitution. There are some people who say Putin is becoming increasingly authoritarian, moving towards a kind of fascist regime, which is a modernizing economic regime, but one that is very controlled politically. Putin is a two-term president. There are term limits in Russia. He explicitly said on Constitution Day last week he's not thinking about changing the Constitution. But in fact, there is talk about him changing the Constitution to allow him to run for a third term. If the political parties, if the liberals are outlawed, if these new orange movements are cracked down on the grounds of terrorism, one could see creeping fascism coming to Russia, one that would promote economic growth and promote the local capitalists, but increasingly cut back freedoms. And whether this affects us or not directly, I think it would be a very sad thing for world culture.
Well, I think there we'll leave it for this time around, with our thanks to our guest, Diane Conker. She's professor of history here at University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
The broadcast today made possible with support from Orange Taxi. It's a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Programming is also underwritten by Baroque Artists for Champaign-Urbana, presenting a German Baroque Christmas on Sunday, December 19th, 7:30 p.m. at Holy Cross Church in Champaign. The program features selections from Bach's Christmas Oratorio and German carols with audience participation. More information is available by calling 378-6802. And that's about where we'll finish up this time around. Just a reminder that on Monday, we will be changing our schedule just a little bit, and we will have two of our monthly regular guests on the program, both of them people who do normally show up on Mondays. One of them will be Hank Spies, the guy who comes in here and answers questions about home maintenance. He knows an awful lot about the way the single-family home is put together. So if you have some problem, something needs to be fixed, you're thinking about doing some remodeling, you need some advice, he's the guy to talk to. Also, we'll be doing our monthly program on women's health. Dr. Suzanne Troopin will be here. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice in our area. She teaches at the U of I Med School. And also once a month, she's on the show to answer questions about her special area practice. So that's Monday. We hope that you will enjoy your weekend. And if you can, tune in for the program then. Of course, we want you to stay tuned because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with a woman who, faced with serious illness, she found comfort and peace in the process of writing. She wrote poetry and letters, and she did something that she calls inner listening. Margaret Micas will join us at 1:06 Central Time this afternoon. Let's take a look.